Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 25th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, and it's so casual. I'm so stuffed. Oh, God. I ate too much yesterday. It's killing me. Oh, God. Well, the amazing thing is it's 3 days before today that I'm saying this, and I already feel like I'm stuffed. I ate too much. I got super drunk so I wouldn't get into a fight with anybody. It didn't work out. Got into a fight with everybody. Now I'm just sitting alone somewhere. I don't know what. I've alienated my immediate family and my extended family. My cousins got into a fight with someone at the supermarket. So here I am, just recording for you the intro to this program. We're going to be playing two interviews I did for Ring of Fire Radio over the past 2 weeks. One is with David Dayan. Get his perspective on the couple of things about the Trump administration would be, and the idea of Obama doing a recess appointment. I know, I'm still fixated on it. It's worth it just if it pounds into your head just how important Supreme Court is. I you know, it may not make a difference for three decades, but so you can tell your kids. And Les Leopold on the program. And the reason why I'm running this one is because it's a story he did that, well, I'll get to it in a minute. But I hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving. Know a lot of people probably traveling today, running from their parents' house or maybe returning from their kids' house, listening to this program. You want to hear these interviews? It's probably going to be a little bit on the short side today. Not so short, but a little bit. But if you want something else to listen to, why not try Secret Crimes and Audio Tape? It's an audio drama told week after week. Don't miss a single episode. You can subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, wherever you listen to podcasts. Some are comedies, some are dramas, some are dramedies. They got all the big themes that you need for a drama or dramedy or comedy, love, mystery, conspiracy, crime. You've heard me talk about the Air Force One. That's my favorite so far, still is. What would you call that? I mean, it's a historical fiction, but I guess it's drama. Love Contract is the one that Michael keeps talking about all the time, this claiming that it's like this office. We have, you know, we're not quite there yet. The HR department is smaller. But you should check these things out. Nice break from politics. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, wherever you listen to podcasts. Matt listens on his. What is the podcast user you use? Dude, what are you doing? Why do you have to take your phone apart? Can't you just tell me?
It was plugged in. I use for Android called Pocket Casts.
Okay. What, you didn't know the name of that? You had to look it up?
I used to have an iPhone, so I'm still kind of new to this stuff.
All right. It's like your favorite TV drama or comedy, but using only sound and your imagination. Don't miss an episode, folks. You can subscribe to Crimes, Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or even Pocket Cast, where you'll be listening like Matt does. All right, so first we're going to play David Dayan's interview and then Les Leopold. And here's the thing about the Les Leopold interview, and this is the reason why I want to replay this so you guys could hear it. It has to do with a campaign promise that Donald Trump made. I don't really care about that, frankly, because everybody knows he's talking out of his patoot anyways. But Les Leopold looks into this air conditioning manufacturer and why they're moving to Mexico. And the obvious reason is because they want to cut labor costs. But then you realize that this company, this manufacturer, it's owned by a bigger one, United Technologies, is the most profitable of all their companies. And why would you risk this? You're the most profitable company. You're going down to Mexico. I don't know. Maybe the people working there will be just as equipped, but why would you do this? Why would you leave? Is it just because of trade deals? No. There's another thing, and it's one of my pet. Here's a little hint. It is it's one of my pet ballywicks. Maybe that it's redundant. And two, it also references Bill Lazonik. And if you haven't heard any of the interviews we've done with Bill Lazonik, I think we've done two. William Lazonik, listen, go back and listen to him. But here's the other part about why I want to play it. It's an important thing for you to know, to understand what's going on with our economy. But it's going to be wholly irrelevant for quite some time. There's something the SEC could do that would have huge implications. But we're in no position now to influence what happens at the SEC. You know, now it's just a question of, can we retain a semblance of the SEC? Never mind fine-tune it. And I wanted to get this out there because it's an important concept for you people to know. But, you know, this type of stuff, we're going to be talking about it, and there's going to be moments. I mean, there's a moment that hit me during the interview. I was like, why are we even talking about this? We might as well be talking about purple unicorns.
Jill Stein, man, 2020.
Jesus. But enjoy it. It's important stuff. Give you a better sense of what's going on in our world. I have to readjust to the sort of the more Sisyphean aspects of doing this kind of show in an era where we're man on the ramparts. But enjoy it, and we'll be back on Monday, folks. Have a great weekend. Talk to you then. So, David Dayan, you are now on the Trump pre-administration beat at The Nation magazine. And so there's a couple issues I want to talk to you about. Let's start first with your piece about our cautioning people to be a little bit nervous about Donald Trump's infrastructure plan. That is not a euphemism for a series of camps, though it could very well be. But what is the supposed Donald Trump infrastructure plan?
Right. So this is the thing that liberals and Democrats have said, well, if we're going to work with Donald Trump on one thing, it would be this infrastructure idea. And you know, I mean, for years, Democrats have been screaming that there's trillions of dollars in deferred maintenance out there in the country. We have these record low interest rates. We could put them to use by borrowing money and fixing roads and bridges and tunnels and the electrical grid and the broadband capacity and all sorts of other things. So Trump, during the campaign, said he wanted $1 trillion of infrastructure. And this, of course, brings jobs. It brings investment in communities that might be able to attract businesses, seemingly a win-win-win. Well, Donald Trump doesn't want to spend $1 trillion in public money for infrastructure projects. He wants to sell bonds so investors will spend $1 trillion in infrastructure projects, and he wants to give them discounts through tax breaks to entice them to buy those bonds. And then he wants to outsource the production of that infrastructure to contractors who would be guaranteed a revenue stream, which of course is the only way investors are going to want to buy these bonds, is if they get something out of it in an enduring fashion. So what this really is a stalking horse for privatization. If you think that what we really need in America is a lot more toll roads, then you're going to be happy with Donald Trump's infrastructure plan, because it's going to privatize all of these public resources and make sure there are user fees on the various pieces of infrastructure so that private interest can make back their investment and more.
So the idea is, okay, we need some new overpasses in California, some bridges on some interstate highways. We're just basically going to finance the private production or construction of these things, and through future revenues and what. I mean, it sounds like all of this sounds like Chris Christie's pumping money into that. What was it? American Dream in the Meadowlands,
yeah.
Just like massive mall that they've already sunk billions of dollars into. I mean, it just a huge boondoggle that never. I think it's still just sort of like, it's like a $4 billion mall that is just not even developed yet.
And you're asking for more boondoggles here, because if you are outsourcing this to a developer and saying you're going to get this amount of profit and this kind of revenue stream, the way that they can maximize that is by doing a terrible job and by cutting corners. We've seen this in a toll road in Texas from San Antonio to Austin, where local residents, because they didn't do the drainage properly on the road, are experiencing flooding anytime there's a rainstorm. So this is one other problem. And the other problem is that the communities who would be getting these infrastructure projects are probably the least likely to be the ones, the most likely to actually need them would be the ones who wouldn't get them. And the reason is that if you need to build in a revenue stream, you're not going to put an infrastructure project in a rural community where those individuals can't actually afford to pay the user fees to use the project, whether it's a road or a bridge or whatever.
I mean, this is almost self-evident, right? Is that the reason why we need infrastructure projects that are, where the government steps in is because it is more often than not not profitable for private enterprise to do so. This is like just a massive subsidy scheme and sort of double. It's sort of like, I guess, double fisted, right? It's a massive subsidy scheme to basically allow private corporations to buy public goods.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about selling off the country, and you're exactly right to indicate that.
And we're subsidizing. We're subsidizing the buyer. We're not even giving the buyer a loan. We're subsidizing the buyer to buy our stuff at discount prices.
Yeah, through a tax rebate. And the claim is that that tax cut will pay for itself because there will be more people at work performing the construction necessary for these projects. and that will bring more tax revenues to the government. So they're doing this tax cut by claiming it would be pay for itself, which is something we've heard throughout conservative policy circles for decades.
And it also, you know, I would also argue that what we've also heard is that government can't create jobs, right? And so
and that private enterprise is always and forever more efficient in these provisions of public services. That's what we've heard out of the private prison industry. That's what we've heard out of privatization projects in schools. Basically, everywhere you go on down the line, the idea is that private enterprise can deliver this service more efficiently. But they're hiding the ball. They may come in under budget, but they're doing a private tax on the individuals who have to pay the user fees to maintain the piece of infrastructure. So you're just shifting the cost from the government to the individual.
Right. All right. Well, David, so is there a broader sort of, I guess, story here? In other words, when Democrats, when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, when they say, like, we will work with, God help me, President-elect Trump to do these things like an infrastructure project, is it always going to be a bit of like a honeypot, a trick, a fraud? Like, is there really any value in even giving, you know, like floating the premise that he's doing something positive? In other words, by calling it infrastructure, I mean, here's my concern is that once you get to the argument of like, this isn't really an infrastructure program, it's just a giveaway to private corporations, has the ship sailed at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that politicians have their own role to play. They have their own sort of internal pressures. They have to make a point that they're willing to work in some fashion on good policy, if such thing exists. I think if that is inevitably the policy that gets thrown out there, then Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders won't hesitate to speak up. The advantage they actually have here is that Paul Ryan is not interested in doing this bill at all. And so the only way it gets done is through an alliance between Donald Trump and Democrats in Congress. And if you know what you're getting into, which is, you know, my role of explaining what the Trump campaign, at least, put out there in terms of this bill, then you have the ability to shape it because Ryan really isn't interested. So, I think that's sort of the gambit here. But it's worth pointing out that what the Trump administration seems to want to do here would be extremely destructive.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about another potential, tact that the Democrats, specifically the sitting president, could take that might actually represent some progress. There seems very few opportunities for us to get there or to create some fissures, to slow the roll, if you will, of the Trump presidency. When we come back, we'll talk about one that is starting to gain a little bit of currency. We'll be right back. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to David Dayan. So, David, we are living in the era of, God help me, the Trump presidency. He is a president-elect. And people are looking for ways in which the Trump presidency, frankly, I mean, let's be honest, can be obstructed. There's plenty of arguments that Democrats shouldn't be like Republicans in terms of norm shattering and whatnot. But from my perspective, one of the things that happened when we saw Republicans shatter norms of governing, whether it was starting out with a plan to obstruct President Obama, to refusing to hold hearings on a Supreme Court nominee, one of the effects of shattering norms is that norms are shattered.
And that's correct.
Now that norms are shattered, it is foolish for there to be norms for Democrats when they're in opposition, as opposed to different norms for Republicans when they're in the opposition. So with that said, let's talk about one thing that Barack Obama, as he's about to see virtually every achievement that he perceives key to his legacy reversed, short of the appointments he made to the Supreme Court, which may just end up being a footnote in history because, frankly, we're looking at decades of a conservative controlled court. Unless something, I have no idea what happens. Maybe an asteroid hits the planet. But there is something Barack Obama can do or attempt to do, and that is a recess appointment of Merrick Garland, who is the current nominee, or frankly, he could pull Merrick Garland, nominate somebody else. Let's start, and let's address whether or not he'd do this at the end. Let's start with why, let's go back to National Labor Relations Board versus Noel Canning. This was a question as to whether or not Barack Obama had the ability to recess appoint one members of the executive branch. But presumably this holds for justices as well.
Yeah, it absolutely does. William Brennan began his court tenure with a recess appointment from Dwight Eisenhower. So you're allowed to do this. It's Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution that the president can fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate. In the Noel Canning decision, the Supreme Court said, well, when the Senate engages in these pro forma sessions where they show up every 3 days, bang a gavel, and walk out, that is technically the Senate being in session. And so what they said is that any recess, whether it's intra-session in the middle of a session or intercession where, the end of the first year of a Congress and the beginning of the second year or the end of one Congress and the beginning of another, those recess appointments have to be made more than 10 days. They said presumptively it would be too short to have an adjournment earlier than 10 days and be legal. So then why do we think that an intercession appointment on January 3rd, 2017, which is the end of the last Congress and the beginning of the new one, why could that work? Well, in Noel Canning, all they were ruling on, the only thing before them was whether these pro forma sessions were legal or not. And they said that the pro forma sessions were legal. Then they added all this other broad language to talk about the number of days before a recess allows an appointment to take place. That is not necessarily a controlling opinion. That can't necessarily be cited as legal precedent. And if you take an aggressive line about this, you could say, the 10-day thing that is not binding, that goes beyond the facts that were presented before you in the case, and I'm going to test that by recess appointing in that split second between the end of the last Congress and the beginning of the new Congress, I'm going to appoint Merrick Garland or whoever and try to stop me. And we can talk about what would happen after that.
Well, presumably, Let's talk about what would happen. I mean, Merrick Garland, if he was game, he would put on a robe. He'd walk over to the Supreme Court and everybody would be looking like, what are you doing here?
Be like, hey, guys, I'm taking my seat. And, the nation's collective head would explode. I think it's pretty clear that if you do this, Trump would denounce Obama's lawlessness. He'd try to somehow impeach him in those 17 days between January 3rd and January 20th. The media would be consumed with this. But the only way to get it to stop, if Obama did it, would be to find somebody who had standing to say that appointment is unconstitutional. And really, the only way you get that is if there's someone who's a plaintiff or defendant in a case before the Supreme Court that Merrick Garland participates in the ruling on, and they say that that ruling should be thrown out because Merrick Garland was unconstitutionally appointed. Now, how long is that going to take? First of all, you got to get him on the court and to do a ruling, number one. Second, you have to find a litigant who's willing to say that you know, to...
They'd find that person within 5 minutes, but okay.
And then you have to go through the lower court process and work your way up until the Supreme Court makes that ruling. So that's a pretty long process. And it would probably take months before the question would get before the Supreme Court.
All right. We just have a minute or so left. Let me just weigh in on that. One, should be done. Should be done. My feeling is anything that chews time of the Trump administration is a positive. Second inclination is to believe that you would want someone different from Merrick Garland, so that if he or she does get thrown off the court, that it there is a wider like emotional investment. And third, Barack Obama will never do this because he's Barack Obama.
Right. And if you bring a butter knife to a gunfight, there are consequences to that. There are consequences to one party being more aggressive about defying yep. norms than the other. And it slides the governing apparatus of the country inevitably, inescapably to the right. And so we need to know that there are consequences to that.
This, we should remind people, this was President Obama's vacancy to fill. This is like unprecedented and nearly, I mean, in many respects, a political coup in terms of denying him this opportunity to fill that slot. So certainly President Obama would be justified in doing it. David Dayan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today.
Great. Thanks.
So, Les, I mean, take us back to the campaign where Donald Trump decided to highlight this Carrier air conditioner facility. Where was it? How? Just set the context for us.
Well, there's a plant in the suburbs of Indianapolis, about 1,400 people. I don't think Trump had any idea its composition, but it's half African American. 50% of the women on 50% of the people on the assembly line there are women. It's an air conditioning factory, and it's owned. The parent company is United Technologies, and over the next 2 years, they're going to move the whole plant, lock, stock, and barrel, to Mexico. So Trump picked up on it as an example of the kind of thing that he would take care of. He was certain that he would get them to cry uncle and that they would, after he was president, that they would change their mind because he would threaten them with a 35% tariff. And he would threaten United Technologies with the same if they didn't keep those jobs here. So what he did is he tapped in. It was a very good way to tap into the trade issue and put Hillary Clinton on the defensive for having supported NAFTA and for having nothing really to say to the carrier workers. So, you know, Trump in his kind of bombastic way went right at it, and then he kept repeating it again and again and again.
Okay, and let's just start with the basic premise. Let's start with, I guess, Trump's end of this premise, right? Not the the premise as to why a United Technology is leaving. Does the President of the United States have a unilateral ability to slap a 35% tariff on a company?
Probably.
Really?
I think it would have to be a category of goods. I don't know if he could do it on one company.
Right.
But I think he has a certain amount of leeway. I'm not a trade expert. I can't tell you exactly what he can do or what he can't do. But and if he couldn't do it that way, he could probably get a piece of legislation passed. The question is, I don't think you could. I think you have to do a category as opposed to a particular company, unless they're violating, you know, some sort of sanctions, which is not the case here.
Okay,
but
so
he could certainly use the bully pulpit. More importantly, he could continually embarrass Carrier and United Technologies for being, you know, he could whoop up anti-corporate sentiment that the rest of the corporate community would be pressuring Carrier, pressuring United Technologies not to make the move. Because
just
it would
so
only,
that they
it
don't
lead
become
to
the
broader
target.
Problems for every for all the corporate elites.
And all right, so let's talk about the reasons why, when a air conditioner factory plans to make the move to Mexico, is this a function of NAFTA? I mean, NAFTA's 22 years old now. I mean, why would they do this now if they had the opportunity to do it before?
Well, that's a great question. And I try to think through the various reasons that are usually said. Like, so for example, most of the media commentators say, you know, the issue isn't trade, the issue is technology. This irresistible force of technological improvement. And that's why American workers are losing their jobs, because they're basically being automated out of existence. In this case, they're literally moving the plant machine by machine to Mexico, same technology. So that reason completely collapses. Another reason cited often is, well, look, they're up against foreign competition and other companies making similar products from around the world using less expensive labor. So they have no choice but to compete by going to low-wage countries, whether it be Mexico or Vietnam or wherever. Well, it turns out that Carrier is the most profitable division of United Technologies. So it actually has nothing to do with profitability or the existence of low-wage labor. What it has to do with is this unbelievable story of wealth extraction from companies and from other parts of society as well through by Wall Street. We call it financial strip mining. It's a process of taking money out of the facility through stock buybacks, literally gathering as much cash flow as possible from within the company, going into the marketplace, and then buying back United Technologies stock. And in doing so, it raises the price of the stock. And the executives who get paid probably half or more of their income comes from stock incentives they gain by it. But most importantly, the largest investors, the hedge funds, are pressing for this again and again. There's 50-some hedge funds that are in United Technologies, and they got United Technologies to do a $10 billion stock buyback just before the announcement of this plant relocation. So the goal is move the plant from Indiana to Mexico, where the wages are, you know, roughly one-eighth as much, take that money saved and use it to buy back their own shares, thereby enriching the hedge fund investors and the top executives. That's been happening in plant after plant after plant all over the country. And before 1982, this was illegal. Why?
Unless before we
go ahead,
get to that part, no, I want, because this is really important, I think, for people to understand this dynamic, because this dynamic explains so much, but is so it's contrary, I think, to the way that most people perceive how business is run or what the agendas are here. Because when we think of, like, why would a company do this? If they're already extremely profitable, why would they do this? And I think the mistake that people make who are not engaged in this type of business in one end or the other, the financiers who are betting these side bets on it, or those people in the corner offices, the C-suites, as they say, people have to understand that these companies are run by individuals who may not have the same, they may have a misaligned incentive with the incentive of a company as a whole. So in this instance, you have CEOs, you have board of directors, you have other chief executives, and you have these hedge funders who, by and large, are not terribly interested in where this company is 15 years down the road. They certainly don't care anything about the communities that they are in. They don't care about the workers. They can make money even if the company slowly fails. And in fact, the success of the company and their ability to make money are sometimes at loggerheads. So just to walk through this again before we go to break, and then we talk about why they're able to do this. The company is running basically at peak efficiency, more or less, right? I mean, it's the highest, it's creating the most amount of profits of all the companies within United Technologies. They have basically hit the wall as to what, how you could get more wealth out of this. And so they make the decision to ship the factory down to Mexico with workers who maybe they're as good as the workers who have been there. We don't know, but we know the workers who are there now have made this company a huge success. But we, but they know those company, those workers in Mexico are paid less, and they're going to use that extra money not to invest in more machinery or into better technology or any of that that would ensure the long-term health of the company. They're just going to use it as a basically a pump scheme, part of the pump and dump, as it were. And I think they're going to end up dumping it. They're going to pump up this stock price by buying back the shares, creating a scarcity of shares, and they're all going to enrich themselves. And the them in this case could be literally just maybe a couple dozen people, maybe even less. When we come back, Les, I want you to explain to our audience how this is legal, because this just sounds like stock manipulation, and it's being done at the expense of the communities, the workers, and probably the long-term health of the company. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Seder on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Les Leopold about this incredible story about why this Carrier air conditioner company was interested in going to Mexico in the first place. We'll be right back after this. So, Les, when we broke, you were telling us this story that started with Donald Trump going to the Carrier air conditioner factory in Indiana and saying that the 1,400 workers there who will leave their jobs because United Technologies is taking this company to Mexico. You were searching for the reason why this was happening to this company, and you stumbled upon, or I guess you reported out, I should say, the main driver was that hedge funds and the owners of huge amounts of stock in this company, the board of directors, the CEO, probably a couple of the other chief executives, they wanted to basically cut costs and use that savings to buy back stock shares and then forcing the stock price to rise. And this is already an incredibly profitable company. So how is this legal? Less. I mean, isn't this stock manipulation?
Absolutely. Here's what happened. In the late 1970s, mid-1970s, a new economic philosophy ripped through the academy and through the policy establishment. And we call it the Better Business Climate Model in my book, Runaway Inequality, but it's in general called, academics call it neoliberalism. The idea is you cut taxes, cut regulations, cut government spending, privatize. It's supposed to lead to an investment profit boom, and then all boats will rise. Well, when they started deregulating Wall Street, it's totally different than deregulating airlines or telecommunications. It's a completely different animal. And what happened was, as soon as they started deregulating, we called them corporate raiders then. Now we call them hedge funds, private equity companies. We've sanitized the name. They went in, bought up companies with borrowed money, stuck all the loans on the company, and start extracting wealth from them. In order to do that, they needed to get the CEOs on their side, either get rid of them or get them on their side. Back then, 1980, 95% of a CEO's pay were salary and bonuses, 5% were stock incentives. Today, it's the other way around. 95% of a CEO's pay is stock incentives on average, and 5% salary and bonuses. So the, in a sense now, the CEO becomes aligned with the corporate raider. The goal is you go to work every day. If I'm getting paid through stock incentives, the goal is to raise the price of the stock by any and all means necessary. There was a rule change that took place in the Security Exchange Commission in 1982 under Reagan. The head of E.F. Hutton became the head of the Security Exchange Commission. He said, hey, we shouldn't have any restrictions on stock buybacks. It was considered stock manipulation and a major cause of the 1929 crash. They threw out the rule, and basically it allows companies to buy back as many shares as possible and to actually move the market. See, that's a violation of supposedly free market economics. You're not supposed to be able to move the price of your goods. You're not supposed to go into the market and be able to manipulate a price. Well, now they can manipulate a price. So the goal, when a CEO goes to work every day in virtually every corporation, the goal is, how do I get more and more cash flow so that I can raise the price of the stock and therefore go to the marketplace, raise the price of the stock, and therefore get more money for myself? And also, the key investors, big hedge funds, take positions in companies and squeeze them for all they're worth. I want to give you, not only is it in Carrier, but I can give you an incredibly stark example from the auto industry bailout. We bailed out General Motors $40-some billion. A guy named Charles Wilson, who was the on the team, on the Obama team that engineered the bailout, went into back to Wall Street where he came from and put together a consortium of hedge funds. They took up a big position in General Motors, and once General Motors developed some cash, which we all thought was going to go into R&D for the most fuel-efficient cars in the world, instead of doing that, they demanded a stock buyback and got a $5 billion stock buyback, squeezed it out of the company, and sure enough, the CEO did well by this process also. So you have a situation where the best image that we have for this, I think, is consider it like a big strip mine coal operation in West Virginia where you just tear down the mountain and get to the coal seam. What they're trying to do is tear down the mountain, the company, get the cash flow, and get it out of the company as fast as possible. This is happening in pharmaceuticals. In my book, I cite all these articles from the Wall Street Journal where they lament how R&D, which is vital to the pharmaceutical industry, is going down, 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 because you can cut R&D, get cash flow to buy back your own shares, and this is what the hedge funds are demanding. This should be illegal again. Trade issues flow from this process, not the other way around. Trade is a misdirected issue. It's the pressure for these trade deals, the pressure to try to, is the pressure to get extract more wealth from
I got to tell you,
and
Les,
by the way, it's
I
not mean, just companies. It's happening at the state and local governments. It's happening to students through student loans. It's happening throughout the society. The strip mining, Occupy Wall Street. Those kids.
As far
they were
as
right.
these companies, it
is.
Seems to me. I mean, the analogy is also it's. I own a horse race, and I'm just going to cut back on what I feed it, and then bet that it's not going to come in first. I mean, that's basically what's going on here. These
guys that happens
have
later.
A
in other
side
words,
bet.
That happens
right?
later. At first, the stock of the price goes up. Over a longer period of time, what happens is the company could then the hedge funds can start betting against it if the company starts going downhill, and then it becomes a target for a maybe a takeover or a bankruptcy proceeding where they can eliminate debt and start the process all over again. But the image is, how can I extract as much money from the American people as possible? And that's what Donald Trump doesn't get. He thinks it's a trade thing, us versus China, us versus Mexico. Of course, that's an element of it. But the real vultures are right here, right in the United States. They're the ones that are feasting.
They're the guys
on us.
Like
and that's
Paulson.
Why, that's
They're
why
the guys
I,
like
I,
Paulson.
I got to get this fact across.
Who
the
were
wage
having
gap was $45
to
$1. Now it's 844 to 1.
They're the guys like John Paulson who are having $250,000 a plate fundraisers for him at in New York City a couple of months ago that nobody reports on. I mean, so he's surrounded by these hedge funders. So
I hate to say it, so was Hillary.
Well, I agree. I just sad to say, I think we probably had a better shot of influencing Hillary. But nevertheless,
yes,
this
true.
SEC rule is the thing to look at, and people should be aware of this so that sometime in the future we can argue this point. But Les Leopold, it's a great piece. It's in the Huffington Post. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tapes, a brand new amazing podcast for sponsoring today's episode. Secret Crimes and Audio Tape is an audio drama told week after week. Feature stories about crime, love, mystery, or conspiracy with actors you know and love. Some are dramas, some are comedies. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts.